At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
With the acknowledgement that the devil, perhaps now more than ever, is in the demonstrable details, there was word late today of a maybe sort of kind of step back in the trade war. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 25th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I am going to say five words right now, completely out of context. Then we're going to put them in context and tell you what they mean. The words are work together toward and non-auto. Here now is the context.
This is why we agreed today, first of all, to work together toward zero tariffs, zero non-tariff barriers, and zero subsidies on non-auto industrial goods. Thank you.
President Trump, obviously today in the Rose Garden, in what was basically a no-notice appearance with European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker, announcing, as you heard, a deal to work on a deal to resolve some of the trade tensions afoot in the European-American economic relationship at the moment. If it all comes together, the EU is set to buy more American soybeans and liquefied natural gas, clearly left on the too-hard-for-right-now pile where the president's threatened tariffs on European carmakers, as we have reported a couple of times, I think those would be the biggies. Speaking of cars and tariffs, General Motors shares took a tumble today as the company said rising steel and aluminum costs helped lower its profit forecast. And GE goes it not alone. Whirlpool, Coca-Cola, and others are starting to tell their stories of tariff pain in earnings reports and price projections and CEO interviews. Now, look, markets are going to do what markets are going to do, of course. But if anybody is surprised by this, they have not been paying attention because, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, this is how tariffs are supposed to work.
It's kind of economics 101. Raise taxes on imports, imports get more expensive. Companies needing that imported steel and aluminum, say for soda cans, end up with higher production costs, which they then pass on to consumers. So these reports from companies aren't surprising to trade experts like Clark Packard at R Street Institute.
It's disappointing to see. But, you know, it's entirely predictable what were the consequences of the president's decisions.
This is the whole point. Make imported items more expensive to protect domestic industries. Great for American steel mills and aluminum plants, but bad for companies with global supply chains like GM, Whirlpool, and Coca-Cola. Josh Zive is a trade lawyer and advocate at Bracewell LLP.
What you know will happen when you impose tariffs like this is you will see spikes in prices across the board, not just increases in prices for imported product, but increases in prices even for domestic product.
Short-term tariffs as a negotiating tactic to improve trade conditions, markets and companies can work with that. But Mary Lovely, an economics professor at Syracuse University, says that's not what this is.
The markets are waking up that this is not just bluster. This is going to happen, and it's going to hurt American companies in two ways. It's going to raise their costs, and it's going to make it harder for them to sell abroad.
She expects we'll see more companies complaining about the ripple effects of the tariffs for some time to come. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
For those like GM and Coke worried about tariffs, the president did offer this today in his very brief remarks.
We also will resolve the steel and aluminum tariff issues.
Which is great, but it's not just the biggies like Whirlpool and Coke and GM taking a hit. We have been talking to businesses all over the country, businesses of all sizes, who are starting to see real effects from the tariffs in their bottom lines already. Ronnie Smith is one of those people. He's the vice president of operations at a family-owned company down in Houston, Texas, called McMahon Steel Supply. They distribute steel tubes and other products to the oil and gas industry down there. Mr. Smith, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you very much.
Just as a way to get going here, help me understand why these tariffs matter to you so much.
Well, majority of the products that we speculate on and put in inventory are all bought overseas, mostly from Japan, Germany, France, and other countries, primarily because most of those products are not produced in the United States.
Okay, so to get to your exclusion or exemption saga, you filed back in April with the Commerce Department a request for a certain number of exclusions, asking that those imported products not be subject to tariffs. What happened?
Well, prior to filing with that, we double-checked with the domestic steel suppliers mm-hmm. that even come close to producing similar steel. And then after we either got responses or were no quoted, we turned around and filed those exemptions. Then subsequently, we noticed that some of the domestic steel suppliers had filed objections to our exemption request.
So I'll tell you what, we've actually followed up with some of those steel companies, one of them in particular, and they said, in essence, we made a mistake and we're trying to fix it with the Department of Commerce. But you are now stuck this is a trite phrase, but a maze of red tape that is affecting your bottom line.
Oh, it's amazing because, you know, any steel that comes into the country or, you know, goes through customs inspections as of June 1st is subject to a 25% price increase for us. This is steel that we ordered 6, 7, 8 months prior to any of this happening. We're forced to pay that, bring the inventory in. We filed for exclusions, and we're finding out that those exclusions were denied based on technicalities that the government has yet to explain to us.
All right, sir. So look, this shows no signs of slowing down, right? The president's talking about more tariffs, not less. The Chinese are doing the same thing. What are you going to do?
Well, all we can do is try to increase our prices and hope that the customer base here, which are guys like Halliburton and Weatherford and Schlumberger and big oil field part manufacturing companies, will continue to absorb the price increases, which basically they say they can buy the steel probably 30 to 35% cheaper in almost any other country in the world. They have manufacturing facilities in Romania, Malaysia, China. We were just told by a customer yesterday that they've moved a large part of their commodity product line out of Texas, mm-hmm. and they're moving it to their manufacturing facility in China.
All right, so listen, the Trump administration says they're going to give $12 billion to farmers that have been hurt by the tariffs. If Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross comes to you and says, hey, here's a chunk of $12 billion to make you feel better, what do you say to that?
I would say let's just let free markets take care of themselves. We don't want subsidies. We don't want tariffs disguised as national security initiatives. It's the United States steel industry's fault that they didn't reinvest in their business since World War II to begin with. You know, and now more than 80% of the steel in the world is produced outside of the United States. That's just an economic fact of life.
Ronnie Smith, Vice President of Operations at McMahon Steel down in Houston, Texas. Mr. Smith, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Kai.
On Wall Street today, somebody at the White House was smart enough to leak that EU thing before the close. Not enough, though, to save Facebook. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In housing news this week, grim is probably too harsh, but not great works pretty well, I think. The Commerce Department reported this morning that new home sales were off 5% May to June. And we told you Monday, June existing home sales posted their third straight monthly decline. A lot of that was straight up costs in a lot of cities. More and more people are being priced out of the market. But the thing is that home ownership in this economy is a huge driver of mobility, economic mobility. So how is this all going to play out? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that one.
Buying a house has traditionally been the best way to build wealth. Just ask Lori Goodman at the Urban Institute.
This has absolutely been a better return on investment for most Americans than investing in the stock market.
Goodman says if you bought a home in 2002 at the median price with 20% down and sold it in 2016, your return after taxes would be around 10%. If you'd put that money in the S&P 500 instead, you would have earned about half that. Goodman says mortgage payments are kind of like forced saving. With every payment, you own a little more of your house. You're living in your nest egg. Plus,
your mortgage payments are fixed if you take out a fixed rate mortgage, whereas rents go up with inflation.
So you've got a nice inflation hedge behind that white picket fence. Your house can help you climb higher on the economic ladder. But what if you can't afford to buy a home? Housing prices have been rising twice as fast as wages, and the Urban Institute says the home ownership rate for American families has fallen around 3% since 2001.
You know, the lower you are on the rungs of the ladder, the more difficult it gets.
That's housing economist Elliot Eisenberg. He says there are a number of factors keeping people out of the housing market.
Not having as much education, not having the opportunity to go to college, for example.
Eisenberg says it's even getting tougher for people higher up on the economic ladder. Think of people living in the hottest housing markets, where high rent can make it hard to save up for a down payment on a house.
I had assumed I would own a home before now.
That's 32-year-old Callan Hunter and her 7-month-old baby, Amelia. Hunter and her husband, Nathan, have been looking for a home in San Diego for 2 years. They have good jobs. She's a lawyer. He's a chief financial officer. But even for them, the San Diego market is just too expensive.
You know, for commute and safety and public schools and all that, there's very limited supply and it's at a very high value right now.
The only homes in their price range are an hour commute from work. So they've decided to hunker down and wait for prices to fall. Hunter's really worried about buying at the wrong time.
We just, once we do enter the market, get scared about how competitive it is because it feels so overheated. How are we ever going to see actual wealth accumulation when it's so overvalued to start with?
Hunter says they could move, find jobs in a more affordable housing market, but other house hunters have already thought of that. Those affordable markets are becoming unaffordable. Home prices in cities like Nashville and Minneapolis are rising, and fast. In the hot housing market of Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There's a whole lot going on in the economic headlines. We know that. That's just the way it is. Today being only the most recent example, that European Union thing. But if headlines are all you're looking at, you're missing most of the story, because most of what really matters in this economy is how people are feeling about their economic day-to-day. That's the basic idea behind a series that we call My Economy. Today, we hear from an entrepreneur here in Los Angeles who makes denim jackets.
I'm Patty Delgado, and I'm the founder and owner at Hija de Tu Madre. So before I started Hija de Tu Madre, I had a freelance design and web design business. So I made a jacket for myself that had a sequin applique of La Virgen de Guadalupe. I just put it together on my old Levi's jacket. And I just knew that the second that I made that jacket, and I just knew that it would be something that would connect really well with other Latina millennials. I started this business with $500, which is nothing, I think. And that was just enough to buy 30 jackets, to buy the appliques, to buy the supplies, and a 1-month subscription to a Squarespace website. And that was it. You know, I was like working from my parents' living room. Literally, my whole business has been started from my parents' couch. And it's been a wild, wild start. I think the first listicle I was in was for this platform called Remezcla, a Latino millennial-oriented platform. And it was like, whoa, this is reaching a bigger audience at such a short period amount of time. Like, I've only been in business for like 30 days. And I think that's kind of when I realized, maybe people do like this stuff. And maybe this would be something that I should pursue further and kind of say bye-bye to all of my design clients. Yeah. I want Hija de Tu Madre to be equal parts e-commerce, cultural empowerment, but also a place for women, particularly Latinas, to find resources to grow their own business. I think every night before I go to bed, I just like am so excited to start the day. I just know that there's always something to look forward to with this business.
This series only works with your help, of course, your stories as well. So please send them to us. Let us know how you and your economy are doing. There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org. Coming up.
She noticed the Archie comics. She said, oh my God, they still make those?
I know, right? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 172 today, 0.6%, 25,414. The NASDAQ gained 91.1% and 0.1%, 79.32. The S&P 500 up 25.9%, 28.46 at the close. Facebook reported disappointing earnings after the bell. Revenue's up 42% for the quarter, but that was below expectations. Facebook shares fell about 9% in after-hours trading. CEO Mark Zuckerberg said some of that was due to the company's, shall we say, privacy issues. As we heard from Kimberly Adams earlier, General Motors slumped 4.6% today after lowering its profit outlook for the year, based partly on rising commodity costs. GM said, and this is important, it's prepared to pass those costs on to consumers. Why is it important? It's important because that's the way tariffs work. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal, continuing with at least part of the theme of the program today, that there seems, emphasis on seems here, to be a step back in global trade tensions, but some damage has already been done. We present to you now the American semiconductor giant Qualcomm. The company had found itself in the crosshairs of the still brewing U.S.-China trade spat. Its $44 billion deal to buy a Dutch chipmaker having been approved by every relevant global regulator except China. Beijing had been dragging its feet for months on this thing, and today, Qualcomm said the heck with it and walked away. You've been hearing talk about the non-tariff ways China could retaliate. Qualitative is the term of art. Yeah, this is one of them. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong explains.
The Qualcomm case is already a lesson in uncertainty for American businesses. If China's involved, firms never really know if their plans are going to go through. And that makes companies risk-averse, says business consultant Daniel Rosen at the Rhodium Group.
When a firm, and for that matter, all firms, get an irrefutable sense that politics is going to play a huge role, it makes them hesitant to make investments that they would otherwise make.
In this trade spat, Beijing has vowed non-tariff, quote, qualitative pushback. What's that mean? Well, slowing up deals and licenses, holdups at customs, website blocking, surprise safety checks, it's all happened before. Jude Blanchett at the Crumpton Group advises American firms in China.
Its qualitative toolkit is pretty robust and runs anywhere from shutting down your retail stores to much more complicated and costly measures, and that is throwing a monkey wrench into your incredibly complex supply chains.
But for China, pushing too hard is risky. It needs foreign investment, says Michael Herson at the Eurasia Group. To him, scuttling the Qualcomm deal undercut that argument.
And that's a message that goes out to the business community, not just in the U.S., but in Europe and other markets, and hurts Beijing's credibility as a market player and a rules-based player.
So this is really a test of whether China wants to play business hardball. It certainly knows how to. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
There are, in the world of pop culture, not too many events bigger than Comic-Con, which happened this past weekend down in San Diego, at which one of the bigger sessions was a panel on a show called Riverdale, the cast of characters of which is lifted straight from a 75-year-old comic book. Archie, along with Jughead, Betty, and Veronica, some of the most iconic comic book characters around, made new again. John Goldwater is the co-CEO of Archie Comics, also the son of one of Archie's original creators. John, welcome to the program.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You basically grew up with this company.
Yeah. I mean, it's been in my blood. And I don't know this for 100% fact, but I'm sure I learned to read by reading an Archie comic.
And honestly,
so I can't tell you that 100%, but they were just there.
You know? Probably not the only person who learned to read. Reading
Archie
comics, right?
You know, it's funny. Like when I go to like Comic Cons or I meet people, whoever they may be, so many people tell me they learned to read through Archie comics.
This is not, however, your father's Archie comics, I think is a kind way to say it. When you took over this company 10-ish years ago, plus or minus?
Yeah, 2009.
What did you feel your mandate was? Because to be honest, Archie had languished.
Yeah, I mean, candidly, I was not really certain where Archie sat in sort of like the zeitgeist of comic book people or just in general in pop culture. And it took me quite a while to really get a handle, candidly, of just how irrelevant Archie was. I'll tell you a very quick story.
Right?
Tell you a very quick story. Yeah. I'm on the train heading into Manhattan. I've taken a couple of my Archie comics with me, and they're on the seat next to me. And a young lady, you know, sat down next to me, and she noticed the Archie comics. And she said, "Oh, my God, they still make those?" And I was like, wow, that hit me right between the eyes. And that was my really moment where I said, okay, we have to figure out how to change things, because otherwise we're going to fade into obscurity like many of these older comic book characters have done.
What was it then that in your mind turned things around for you? What was the decision you made?
Well, I mean, the first thing I did was I called a meeting of all our writers and our artists into the office, and I said, everything is on the table. No idea is a bad idea. Just tell me what you want to do. I promise you I'm not going to fire you. I want any and all ideas from you guys, because you guys are the lifeblood of Archie. The writers, the artists, they're our lifeblood.
You said in an interview not too terribly long ago, you said, as long as the story feels true to the spirit of the characters, it can be anything. Archie fights zombies, has powers towards the world. There is no limit to what you can do with these amazing characters, which is amazing in itself because they're 75 years old.
Yeah, it's all about DNA, right? So if the DNA and the integrity of the personalities of the characters are true to who they were 75 years ago, I mean, Archie's still a good guy. And, you know, he's still best friends with Jughead. As long as they're true to themselves, it works. And we've proven that. It's actually amazing, to be honest with you.
Why did you decide television in Riverdale? It's a little dark, right?
Yeah. Look, again, it goes back to the DNA sort of conversation. Yeah. If they're going to be in Riverdale and it's just going to be high school hijinks, you know, candidly, that's kind of boring, you know? And, you know, we want to tell compelling stories. You know, we want all the young people that watch the show to be able to relate to the characters. And the world is not rainbows and unicorns all the time, let's face it, right? I mean, there's a lot of stuff that goes on in the world. You know, we wanted to tell a story that was today and that was relevant.
Do you look at DC and Marvel and the Wonder Womans and the Avengers and the Thors and say, that's where I want to go?
Well, I look at Archie as being in the same sandbox as them for sure.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, our IP is as famous as theirs, except, you know, in a different way.
Well, so are you underperforming?
No, not at all. I mean, look, we're catching up. I wouldn't say underperforming. Actually, I think we're overperforming because I think people sort of left us for dead. And now people are like, oh, wow, I'm so happy you're doing this. It's like, I always love these characters. Thank you for putting some life back into them.
What do you suppose your dad would make of what you're doing with this character and these people?
I don't think he would ever have believed that this were possible. I mean, he passed away in 1999. And I've got to tell you, candidly, he never thought Archie was going to endure. Mm-hmm. And if he saw what's happening with Riverdale and how people are just in love with the characters, in love with Betty and Veronica, I have to tell you, I think he would be completely flabbergasted in a great way, in an absolutely great way.
John Goldwater, Archie Comics. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
There was, of course, lots more Archie stuff for John and me to talk about, so we did. You can hear the whole interview on our Corner Office podcast. This final note on the way out, another economic and, yes, political word of the day, emoluments, noun. The returns arising from office or employment, usually in the form of compensation or perquisites, trending, the good people at Merriam-Webster say. Searches on it up 9,100% today because a federal district court judge has ruled that an emoluments lawsuit against President Trump, alleging he is improperly benefiting from Trump Organization business transactions with foreign governments, can be allowed to move forward. If you want some further reading on this, it's Article 1, Section 9, Clause 8 of the Constitution of the United States. All right, we got to hit it. The market's got a nice little bump from that pre-close EU trade thing that happened at the White House today. Dow Industrials up 172, NASDAQ up 91, S&P 500 up 25. Those are all in points. Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.